This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm Bill Moyers. Like you, I don't want to think about death, especially my own. But I've realized that death is pushing through the door we try to keep so firmly shut.
Bill Moyers has a new PBS series about death and dying. But the focus isn't just on dying. It's on trying to live a decent life in the face of death, and on the movement to improve care at the end of life, such as new approaches to pain relief and hospice care. The series also examines some of the difficult personal and medical choices faced by people who are dying and their loved ones. The series is called On Our Own Terms. It premieres Sunday evening on most PBS stations and continues over the next three consecutive nights. Over the course of the series, cameras take us into the homes, hospitals, and hospices to meet people with terminal illnesses and the doctors and nurses who care for them. One of the people we meet on the first edition is Dr. Bill Bartholomew, a pediatrician who was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus, a terminal diagnosis.
I think I went through a process. There was a period of about 6 months after the diagnosis that I experienced a kind of grief that I had never known. A crying, you know, uncontrollably, bawling till you have no more tears. It was suffering that transcended pain. I mean, I had a lot of pain during that time, but it was not in the same league as the suffering. But that didn't really last very long. You do get the rewards of your grief work, and those are that you move down the road to a place where it's okay, and you can begin embracing that reality and discovering what it's like to live in what I've been calling the light of death, live as a terminal person.
I spoke with Bill Moyers about his new series, and he told me that working on these interviews with people facing death was different from what he'd experienced before.
Usually I will conduct a series of interviews, and then we'll go into the editing room, and I'll watch the people on the screen, and casually, idly in the back of my mind, knowing that they're going on about their business. The politician's out on the campaign stump, a business executive is running his company, a writer is sitting in her study writing. But in this, after we'd done the interviews, everyone that I interviewed in the course of the year of reporting died before we or while we were editing. And so we were seeing these people on our Avid machines, on our editing machines, after they were gone. And it was a strange experience of seeing the image after the reality, of knowing. It just made me realize that one day somebody will be looking at my image on an editing machine and I won't really be around anymore. So I was constantly processing this, constantly being reminded of my own mortality and thinking one of these days I'm going to have to set aside my professional reaction to this subject and really deal with it personally.
You did a survey of what Americans' biggest fears of death are. What were the results you came up with?
Whatever their backgrounds, people said they most fear reaching the end of their lives hooked up to machines. They just want a gentle closure. They want a dignified death. They want not to die in a nursing home or a hospital. In fact, the survey you're referring to, I think, said that 80% of the people said they would prefer to die at home, not in a hospital or a nursing home. However, the fact of the matter is that 4 out of 5 of us will die in a hospital or a nursing home or some other institution outside our own home. That's what people fear.
Pain was one of the things that people seem to fear most about death. And pain is the subject of the second edition of your series on death and dying. I thought there were some interesting distinctions made between hospice and its approach and palliative care. Palliative care is dealing with pain within a hospital setting as opposed to a hospice setting. What are the differences you came away with between hospice and palliative care?
Well, it's a very fine difference. When you're in a hospital and doctors are either trying to save you or trying to comfort you, they bring a great deal of professional skill and training to the task. So it's institutionalized care, even if it is palliative or comfort care. Palliative care is comfort care. You know that the person can't be cured, so you will try to comfort that person as she dies. Hospice is a way of just providing human comfort. It uses very little technology, no technology. Hospice is the human touch. So is palliative care, but palliative care relies more on the medicine and on. Well, let me give you an example. My own mother died last year, 1999, at the age of 91. It took her three very hard years to die. I'll never forget the day 3 years earlier when she literally stopped aging, in my mind, literally stopped aging and started dying. I was sitting at her bedside, her forehead wrinkled, her eyes closed, her jaw slackened, her fingers curled into a fist. I mean, the person that I had known for 60-some-odd years of my life just suddenly disappeared. I made a lot of mistakes during those 3 years. I didn't know enough about the breakthroughs in palliative care, comfort care. I mistook the inscrutability of the doctor for authority. My doctor would not give my mother enough pain control, enough pain management. I finally had to let him go and bring in another doctor. This doctor said, "Mr. Moyers, your mother's not going to make it. You should call in hospice. Hospice will make sure that she has as much comfort as is possible." The striking thing to me, Terry, here I was, a man in my early 60s, worldly, wise, traveled, experienced in government and politics, publisher of a newspaper, 30 years a broadcast journalist, and I didn't know how to take care of my mother. I didn't know about hospice. So fortunately, I called in hospice. And what is hospice? Hospice are nurses who are trained in dying, in helping you die a gentle death, and volunteers who come to provide a personal presence, to be a witness to your death. That survey you mentioned earlier, people fear dying alone. Well, a hospice volunteer makes sure that you don't die alone. And my mother died on the very first day, April 12th of last year, the very first day that we were filming for this series. I was interviewing Frank Ostaseski, whom you'll see in the first show, at his hospice center in San Francisco. And my wife was with me as the executive producer of the series, and she interrupted us when we were changing tapes and said, "You have a message." I went out into the hall, and she said, "Your mother's dead." Well, my mother died quietly, holding the hand of the hospice volunteer, a remarkable woman named Jenny Mahood. The last thing Jenny Mahood said to my mother in that nursing home was, "You know, Mrs. Moyers, your family really loves you." And my mother, who hadn't spoken or indicated much response over the last 3 years, a tear, says Jenny Mahood, formed on my mother's cheek and quietly crept down her cheek. And I thought, what hospice did, what Jenny Mahood did, was to provide a witness to my mother's death, a friend who was present at that moment. And that's what hospice does.
Was there a part of you that felt really bad that your mother was holding the hospice worker's hand and not yours?
No, I didn't feel really bad. I wished I had been there, but I doubted that I could be there whenever it occurred because of the peripatetic and unpredictable nature of the journalist's life. I'd spent a good bit of time, as had my wife and our grandchildren, with my mother over those 3 years that she was with us. It just so happened that I was gone on that particular day. There was no way to predict that day. I made sure that in those 3 years, while she was just 15 minutes from our house, that I would spend as much time as I could. The sad thing is that as my mother disappeared into her death, And I would sit by her bedside and talk to her. I couldn't get a response. Now, you never can be sure that the dying person isn't hearing. In fact, doctors and hospice workers will tell you, be careful what you say in a hospital room or the death room or at home where your loved one is dying, because they can often hear when you don't think they could. But I got no response from my mother, despite spending many hours of being at her side. And I think the great value of being there was for me. But back to your point about palliative care, in the second broadcast, you'll see some teams of palliative care physicians and nurses who do it right. They've got it right.
What interested me about the distinction between hospice and palliative care, getting back to that, is that, you know, if you sign on to a hospice, you are signing away your ability to, say, call 911 and get an ambulance. You're signing away your ability to have any real medical intervention outside of dealing with the pain. And I think for a lot of people, that's really terrifying. It's saying, like, they've totally given up on me, and all the things that one relies on in medicine are no longer mine. All I can get is the comfort care. And I'm not sure whether that's because of the philosophy of the hospice or because of the definition that insurance companies have placed on hospice so that they're limiting their costs.
It's a combination of all of those factors. We did a survey in which, well, we saw a survey in which only 14% of doctors said that they ever talked with their patients about their terminal diagnosis. And one of the reasons they said that they didn't, apart from their own caution, their own inability to talk about it, and that we can come back to that later, the hard time doctors have of talking about death. But one of the reasons they don't is because they don't want the patient to feel that the doctor's given up. Even when a patient knows she's dying, she's not sure that she wants the doctor to know to think that she's dying, because the doctor then might not do something would make a difference. But the fact of the matter is that when you do reach that point, like Bill Bartholomew, the pediatrician in the first show, reaches, you do admit to yourself and hope that your family admits to itself that death is approaching and that it's a mistake, a serious mistake, to try to prolong it with a lot of intervention. And that moment is very difficult to reach. That moment is very hard to decide. That's why this is an art and not a science. Dying is an art. It's not a science.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Moyers, and his new series, On Our Own Terms, Moyers on Dying, premieres on most PBS stations Sunday, September 10th. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Moyers, and his new PBS series, On Our Own Terms, Moyers on Dying, premieres on most PBS stations Sunday, September 10th. Your new series looks at, you know, many different aspects of the process of dying, emotional aspects, medical aspects. When the series was over, did you re-examine, like, your own insurance policy, your living will, your own funeral plans, things like that? Did you do, like, a tune-up in your own preparations?
I started, yes. My wife and I, one of the first things we did after coming back from interviewing Dr. Bartholomew in Kansas City, who was dying when we interviewed him, was to update our health proxy, our advanced directive. Even a sophisticated and knowing man like Bill Bartholomew realized in the course of his dying that he didn't have enough coverage for hospice, and that his advance directive, his health care proxy, his instructions to the people around him had a loophole in it that might mean, despite his wishes, efforts would be made to prolong his life. So he came up with what he called a naked, durable power of attorney, something I'd never heard of, but it makes it very explicit that, in this case, his wife, Pam, had the sole and controlling and total authority to make the decisions for him. My wife and I came back, went to the lawyer, had our advanced directives fine-tuned to that distinction, so that there's no doubt now if something happens to her or if something happens to me, the other of us has the power to make those decisions. Not the doctor. not the hospital, not even a member of our family if one of us is there. We did that. The interesting thing is, you know, death is still the last taboo. It is still very hard to talk about, even though the last time I looked, the death rate remains the same, one per person. We still don't like to talk about it. And there was a time when we'd finished the series when Judith and I were sitting on our couch in the apartment, and I said to you, you know, we have never really addressed the issue of where you want to be buried. Where do you want to be buried? An hour later, we were still discussing the issue, but we hadn't closed it. We hadn't come to that point of a declaration. Well, this is where I want to be buried. She said to me, where do you want to be buried? I have made the decision that I want to be cremated. Well, where do you want your ashes spread? Well, I don't know. So even though we have been through this experience for the last 2 years of working on this series, we still have a hard time closing the deal, so to speak.
Is it easier for Bill Moyer's journalist to talk about death than Bill Moyer's husband and father?
Yes. I think one of the reasons that I've been a journalist this long is that it enables me to deal with a lot of subjects that personally I do not want to confront myself or don't understand myself. I mean, we journalists are licensed to explain things we don't understand, and there's a lot I don't understand, and there are some things that I just simply have a hard time individually and humanly coming to terms with. This was one of them. I don't think it is anymore.
Getting back to the example you were giving a moment earlier about the power of attorney that Dr. Barthelme, a former pediatrician who was dying of cancer of the esophagus, had given to his wife. He wanted his wife to decide when medical intervention should be stopped and he should just be allowed to die. Now, in the series, you ask her how she felt about having this awesome responsibility. Tell us what she said to you, and also, was she called upon to actually use that responsibility and decide when medical intervention should stop and he should be allowed to just die?
She said to me, I asked her if she thought it were unfair that she had to make that decision. And she said, no, it's not as unfair as it would be if some stranger had to make it, if the physician had to make it, if a nurse had to make it, that she thought this was part of their relationship and part of her responsibility. She was fully present and participating in the last hours of his death. I don't think that she was confronted with that stark moment when it was go or no go. He had already decided on his descent. They anticipated its arrival, and they faced it together, and then Bill just quietly, with her presence, And her participation, Bill just quietly died. He died, she thinks, the way he wanted to die. He had some struggle. He had some difficulties. Even though he was a knowing man who had made all the preparations he thought were right, he still had some struggle. Everybody does. Look, we do search for a good death, but death is rarely easy. And that's why one can't be too glib about it. You know, we can talk about a good death. We can seek a good death. We can make plans for a good death. But at the end, it is so final, as far as we know. And it is so, there's so much loss attending a death. The loss of loved ones, the loss of presence, the loss of participation in what's going on around you. It's hard. And he had a hard time. Most of the people that I interviewed had a difficult time right up until they had passed that moment of finally acknowledging or receiving the knowledge of death. And then most of them did die a more peaceful and quiet death than I would have thought. And Bill Barthelme did too. Bill Barthelme, by the way, taught me so much in the course of my many hours of interviewing him. People have asked me, you know, was reporting this series depressing? And I honestly say no, because the dying have taught me so much about living. And Bill Barthelme was 50, as you'll recall from the film, when he was diagnosed with incurable cancer and given just a few months to live. But he managed to survive another 5 years. And he said to me in the interview, which you have seen and the audience will see when the series starts on Sunday evening, living in the light of death is the most exquisite experience in my life, he said. If you don't expect to see spring. And then you see it. You don't experience it as spring. You experience it as a miracle.
But you know what I thought was really interesting? His wife said that it's not that kind of miracle for the person who's close to the dying person.
That's the agony of survival. I mean, there was a moment in the film when we caught her. He said he comes home and talks about his diagnosis and talks about his difficulty. And she makes a very human, spontaneous remark. Well, what about my diagnosis? Something to that effect. And I ask her in the interview, isn't it hard? If he's living in the light of death and he's experiencing that, you're living in the shadow of his death. How is that? And she said, it's hard. It's really hard not only to watch him die, but to have the light so focused on him. He, the dying, occupies center stage. And for the period of the dying, it's his show. It's his script. And everything is focused on him. And she said, I understand that, but it's hard to take it. And I found that so true in so many other experiences as well.
You're trying to lead a national discussion now on the subjects of death and dying. Was death discussed in your family when you were growing up?
No, not explicitly. Death was all around. My mother lost three of her children before they were 2 years of age. My brother, my older brother, died at the age of 39 in 1966. He was just 7 years older than me. my father lost his father in the flu epidemic of 1918. Death was a constant reality in the lives of my family, and it was just there. We didn't talk about it as death. Death. It was just talked about in terms of, well, Mr. Pace, Paul Pace died last night. My father was very active in the Little Baptist Church where I grew up in Marshall, Texas. And any time any member of the church died, the elders of the church organized themselves to provide a round-the-clock vigil for them. My father always took the 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning shift. He would go down for an hour and just sit there in the presence of the corpse. Even though my father would get up at 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the morning and go to work as a truck driver, he would do that. Other men in the church did it too. Death was to be witnessed. Death was to be attended. It wasn't so much to be talked about.
What did your brother die of in 1966?
He had throat cancer. He was a heavy smoker, and he went too early.
What was it like for you to have your brother die at such a young age?
It was totally unexpected. It was like receiving a visitor, death from another world. It was, you don't expect your 39-year-old brother to die. You just don't expect it. You expect to grow old together. And there was a sudden loss, a sudden emptiness, a sudden disappearance from your life. And it took me a good while to come to terms with it. I don't think death is ever accepted so naturally as we like to think it should be.
Well, just a few years before your brother died, you were close to one of the most traumatic deaths of the century, the assassination of JFK. I think you were even on Air Force One with the body carrying him back from Texas. That must have thrown your life into upheaval.
It did. It was one of those events that erupts that change the direction when you don't consciously change it yourself. I mean, when you come out of that experience, the road that you were on is closed and there are new roads open that you're on without even knowing that you've chosen to be on those roads. And that's what happened. I was having lunch on the 22nd of November in Austin, Texas, with the chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee and future Lieutenant Governor of Texas. And we were celebrating the very significant success of John F. Kennedy's trip to Texas. I had been down there to advance that trip at President Kennedy's request, and we saw that it was going beautifully. He'd had big response in Houston, a big response in Fort Worth, and it landed in Dallas on a blue, clear day and large crowds. And we were celebrating at lunch when we were interrupted by a phone call from this friend of mine in Austin, the manager of the local station, who said something's happened in Dallas. So I called the Secret Service, Bill Payne, who was the Secret Service agent in with whom I was working, and he said, there's been a shooting, and we think the president's hit. So Frank Irwin, the chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee, and I raced out to the local airport in Austin, chartered a plane, and flew to Dallas, halfway between Dallas and Austin, over Waco, Texas. Robert Trout, I think it was Robert Trout, said, ladies and gentlemen, the president is dead. I did land at Love Field, go on Air Force One for the swearing-in of Vice President Johnson as president, and we flew back to Washington. Mrs. Kennedy and the coffin, and Kenny O'Donnell and Larry O'Brien, all of the loyal Kennedy folks were on that plane. It was a strange time, like passing through some underwater passage that where all sound was muffled and all sight was unfocused, and there was an eerie silence on the plane. No one seemed to know how to respond or what to say. Larry O'Brien and I began to talk, and Kenny O'Donnell, who almost always never had anything to say, and I did go back once to where the coffin was, and Mrs. Kennedy was sitting there, the bloodstain still on her dress, and suddenly the world had been silenced by death and changed by death, and none of us knew at that moment what had happened, what was going to happen. All we knew was that the president was dead, and dead was real.
A lot of Americans took a day of mourning. A lot of businesses, movie theaters were closed. And, of course, family is supposed to take time to mourn and to fall apart if they need to. But as a political professional, it was your job to make sure things didn't fall apart and to keep things moving forward.
And we did. It was almost automatic. Liz Carpenter was on that plane. Jack Valeni was on that plane. Lady Bird was on that plane. The president, of course, was on that plane. And decisions started being made automatically, but always in the context of apprehension that we'd be moving too fast into that circle of grief from which Mrs. Kennedy had not yet recovered. I mean, it was the most awkward moment I can imagine a president ever being in, of having to start immediately, not by choice, but by circumstance, to make decisions, even as the widow of his slain predecessor was on that very same plane. I will always, whatever Lyndon Johnson's great outsized flaws were, I will always be in deep admiration of the sensitive way he began to be president, even as he knew in the minds of many people on that plane he could never be president. I mean, I said to him at one time, he was on the phone with the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, in Washington. We were on the phone with J. Edgar Hoover trying to get information about what the FBI knew regarding the Kennedy assassination. We were on the phone with Robert McNamara. The president was talking to a variety of people. And then there was one moment when he fell into a very obsessed silence. He was preoccupied in his own mind, and he was staring out the porthole. He had raised the shade a little bit. We were told to leave the shades down on the flight back, and we did mostly, but occasionally we would look out to see what we could see. And I found the president in his cabin looking out the porthole, and I said, Mr. President, which was awkward in itself, although it came naturally, because I think that title just goes to the man who's taken the oath. But I said, what are you thinking? And there was a long pause, and he said, are the missiles flying? And I realized he was struggling with, what was this a Soviet attack? Was our Cold War nemesis behind this? Could this be the precipitation of some conflict, some of war? Of course, we were quickly assured that it wasn't, but I was intrigued by how that played on his mind.
You know, in your early career, you were in politics as an aide to LBJ. Then you were in network news covering political issues. Your programs have gotten so much more personal. Your programs have discussed the meaning of myth, religion, health, now death and dying. How do you explain that shift in your professional subject matter from the political to the more personal?
I don't really know, Terry. I'm not sure, except that you are so caught up in politics and government in a cocoon, in a world of language that isn't quite real, isn't quite descriptive, of concocted language and realities, that it takes a while to remove yourself from that programmed world, from that intense and starkly focused world where everybody's trying to do the same thing, govern or win or pass legislation. That when I got out and I was in there so early, so young, I was 26, I think, when 29 when I went to the White House with the president, that my world was very circumscribed. And for 7 years I lived in that cauldron, in that cocoon. And when I got out and went back to my first love, I had started at a newspaper at the age of 15 in Marshall, Texas. When I went back to publish a newspaper at the age of 33, I went back. I allowed myself to move more slowly but more deliberately into a wider sphere of experience than politics and government. And I'd always known, growing up in a little town, Marshall, Texas, how the most important news was routine news. Who was born? Who was married? Who joined the church? Who died? Who was sick? Who went off to war? And so as I began to practice journalism in my own right, that earlier awareness of what really matters to people is mostly what is personal, that began to inform my journalism. And I began to cover stories and issues that you just don't think about in government and politics, and that journalism, if one is lucky, offers one a license to explore. So I began to take my stories from life and not my stories from the dramas of politics and government.
My guest is Bill Moyers. His new PBS series, On Our Own Terms, Moyers Undying, premieres Sunday evening on most PBS stations. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Moyers. He has a new PBS series about dying and end-of-life care called On Our Own Terms. You know, after investigating, you know, religion, myths, poetry, medicine in the mind, death, has doing all those shows had a big personal impact on you? I mean, even in terms of what matters to you most about your career now compared to what you thought would matter to you most, about what you wanted to achieve in your career by this time in your life?
I didn't think so much of a career as I thought of work. Mm-hmm. Work is so wonderful. I just love it. It's a continuing course in adult education. I don't think less of work now than I ever did because I'm older. I've done these things, as you said. I still do something because I learn from it. On the other hand, it is true that I have a sense of the narrowing tunnel of time. Believe me, Terry, I know. Somewhere during the course of our filming, I think it was in Louisiana, Shreveport, Louisiana, after I'd come back from interviewing Jim Witcher, whom you'll meet in the third broadcast in the series, who is dying a difficult death of Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. I was sitting in my hotel room on the Red River there, looking out not far across the way to my home, where I'd grown up just 30 miles away. I think it was at that moment that it struck me that every night I'm pitching my tent a day's march nearer my death. Now, imagining that moment of my death has helped me to see that First, what I want for myself is what everyone wants, a gentle, dignified end, free of pain, witnessed by the people I love. I want time to say thank you to the people who've enriched my life. I want to ask those I've hurt to forgive me. And I want to say goodbye to those I love. But imagining my death, I think the greatest impact of this series on me has been that to imagine my own death has made me far more aware of the time I have left, so that every moment, as Bill Bartholomew said, matters. This moment matters. This moment between you and me, at this moment, it matters. It's not something I'm doing on the way to somewhere else. It matters. And if I don't connect at this moment, I won't get it back. This is not melodramatic. It's not like a vision from heaven. It's just a realization that when you camp every night a little bit closer to your own death, that moment, that camp, that evening really matters. And that, I think, has had a more important impact on me than I would have thought when, as a journalist, I was going out to report this story.
Yeah. Of the people who've been close to you who've died, have you seen both traumatic deaths and more peaceful deaths? And I guess I'm wondering if witnessing people not who you've met as a journalist, but who you've known as friend or family, if that's affected what you think of as the experience of dying, what you've prepared yourself for.
Well, that's a very good point, because you know every life is a particular life, and every death is a different death. We all die our own death, so that there is no universal death that occurs in the same way in every life. My brother's death in 1966 was traumatic. My mother's death in 1999, after 3 years of suffering, was just one of those slow, painful, agonizing deaths that none of us, you know, want. My father fell and punctured his lung. It was in Marshall, Texas. I was in New York when we got the call, and he died. Had a painful experience in where he was in the home, in the nursing home, and then died with just professionals around him in the hospital. You know, every family has a different set of issues to deal with, and every death takes its own course. And here's the thing that has struck me, and it strikes me as I'm just talking to you now, putting in perspective the varieties of death that have affected me. The path to our dying depends on the decisions of so many individual people. I mean, the Institute of Medicine conducted a 3-year study some years ago and concluded dying patients are not receiving the care they need and physicians are not prepared to provide it. That's one reason that we have so many different kinds of death. So all of these deaths together have forced me to try to imagine my own death. Look, I'm 65. I'm 1 year past the time when the federal government would have deemed my death to be premature. It is no longer premature. 65 is the time at which, you know, death starts, no longer becomes premature. So I have to be aware of that. And I try to look at these deaths I have experienced and witnessed or known about in my own personal circle and say, what kind of death am I going to have? And so help me, Terry, I can't figure it out, because there's no way we can really know.
That's right. That's right. You know, having done your series on death and dying and examined the medical system and a little bit about what insurance covers within the medical system, what are some of the conclusions you've reached about what most needs to be fixed?
The one thing we could do to improve dying would be to pay caregivers a living wage.
You mean home caregivers?
Well, I'll come back to that, but all caregivers. I mean, most deaths are witnessed and attended by people who are underpaid for it, whether it's in the home or, you know, a nurse in a hospital. But we need to pay caregivers a living wage. Second, we need to change Medicare. It's our system. We can change it. We should change it. We need to change Medicare so that care for the dying at home receives the same priority that is afforded those who are rushed to the emergency room and hooked up on machines. I mean, I'm more likely to get adequate coverage if I am stricken right here and taken to the Mount Sinai emergency room up the street than I am if I'm dying a more slow death at home. We need to make it possible for people to die at home with the comfort and care and attention that they need. Hospice is largely limited, not exclusively, but largely limited to the last 6 months of life. You have to have a diagnosis that you're going to die within 6 months in order to get coverage for hospice care at home. We need to change that. Joanne Lynn, who is a wonderful advocate for changing the provisions that cover death, insurance, Medicare, all of that, she says, you know, if we don't recognize that it is our system and that we need to change it so that we can make sure that dying is financially not, doesn't wipe people out, that people can afford the care that they get, then we're going to have a real crisis when the baby boomers reach that point, not of retirement, but of mortality. So there's a lot we need to do. And by the way, one of the reasons we did this series was first to get people talking about death and dying, because talking about death is the best weapon against our fear of death. And second, to try to trigger, as you said earlier, a national conversation about the inevitability of it and how we can prepare for it, how we can prepare for it emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, and financially.
Well, Bill Moyers, I thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with your broadcast, which will begin on Sunday. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Moyers' new PBS series about dying and end-of-life care is called On Our Own Terms. It premieres Sunday night on most PBS stations and continues on the next three consecutive nights. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the folklore surrounding words believed to have racial origins. This is Fresh Air.